group has done is something they approve of. So they're not just backing a prescribed terrorist group. They're backing actions like attacks on British military bases. And I see no world in which a sensible country would allow that as mere expression. I mean, America, where I spend much of my time, has probably the freest speech laws in the world, thanks to the First Amendment. And lots of things can be said there in the media and indeed on the streets that would not be illegal on the streets or in the print pages of British media. But in America, with the freest speech laws in the developed world, which means in the world, and there's no world in which attacking US military bases will be regarded as mere expression of opinion.
Douglas Murray, Associate Editor of The Spectator, thank you very much indeed for sharing your views on free speech and the press. That's it from me, Daniel Finkelstein. Aisha Azarika's here from 1pm tomorrow. My producer was Lizzie Highfield, done a brilliant job this week, and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons with Ilan. And on The Times at 1 next week, it's Stephen Sacker. Right now, Jane Garvey is next on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
2 o'clock, good afternoon to you. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. And on the programme today, more pupils than ever before are getting top grades in their A-levels. Congratulations to you if you're one of them. I'm going to be talking to the head of the Russell Group of Universities. We'll get the latest on the upcoming Alaska summit between Presidents Putin and Trump. If you're sweating gently as you listen to this, you might sympathise with calls for a minimum and maximum temperature at work. We'll ask if that's an idea whose time has come. That's on the programme a little bit later. And my big interview this afternoon is with the crime writer and the creator of Karen Piri, her of the bum bag. It's Val McDermid after 3.30 this afternoon. Here is the news at 2 from Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Officials say there was a powerful sense of unity during a meeting between Sakir Starmer and Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street this morning. Number 10 says they discussed Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Alaska tomorrow. Journalist and foreign affairs expert John Kampfner has told Times Radio that's the only thing that matters.
Everything hinges on Trump and Putin. All the other announcements, initiatives, Zelensky's constant trips around Europe, they are as nothing compared to the vagaries of Donald Trump's mind and what Vladimir Putin may or may not persuade him to believe in Alaska tomorrow.
Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine have exchanged 84 prisoners each. Volodymyr Zelensky says they include Ukrainian civilians held in Russia since 2014, 2016 and 2017. Russia says its freed soldiers are in Belarus for psychological and medical assistance. The man accused of driving into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade is facing an additional 24 charges, including assault against two babies. More than 130 people were injured when Paul Doyle allegedly drove his Ford Galaxy into a crowd of supporters on May the 26th. Boys have outperformed girls at A-level for the first time in 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been opening their results, with a record number getting a place at their first choice university. Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson has advice for those who are unsure what to do next.
If you've got what you've needed to move on to the next step in your journey, that's fantastic. But if you haven't, there's lots of support and advice that's available either from your school or college, but also through UCAS if you're considering going to university through clearing. And also the National Career Service.
The Tories say the economy is in a period of stagnation after figures showed economic growth in the UK had slowed. GDP expanded by 0.3% in the 3 months to June. That's down from 0.7% in the previous 3 months. It's feared that great British puddings are dying out. Classics like rhubarb crumble, sticky toffee pudding and treacle sponge are on the verge of extinction, according to English Heritage. Fewer families bake and younger generations are turning to ice cream instead. Sandy Doherty, a former Great British Bake Off contestant, has told Times Radio that perhaps they just need to be smaller.
I think there's a way possibly of maybe incorporating them into chocolates, get those flavours into a box of chocolates to have with coffee or something like that. I think we do think that you've got to have this nailing down feeling from a British pudding that nails you to the floor in front of the television on a Sunday afternoon after you've eaten a double helping of rhubarb, crumble and custard.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Still thinking about that, a pudding that nails you to the floor. Yes, please. Are you going to choose a way to go? I think it might be that. Honestly, I think if I were to have a Last Supper, it would be jam roly-poly. And would I have cream or custard? I don't know, that's the big debate. 0333 003 2353. This is Jane Garvey. I'm here until 4 o'clock. Fee isn't here this week, she's on holiday. She would be back on Tuesday. So between now and 4 o'clock, the A-level results are out. The Russell Group speaks in a moment. Later in the programme, we've got Jane Mulcairns. She went to Oxford. She's the Associate Editor of the Times magazine, and she joins us to look ahead to what awaits in the mag this weekend. It does include a feature in which four quite brilliant young Oxford and Cambridge graduates talk about their struggle to get work. It isn't easy out there at the moment. AI, obviously, hugely influential and coming for us in any number of different ways. Not all negative, but it's probably not the easiest time to have left university and to be looking for work, however brilliant your degree. So we'll talk about that. Growth is slightly up. Dare we be mildly optimistic? What do you think? And is it you, or is it incredibly clammy wherever you are? How hot should your workplace be? We're going to be asking, what is the most luxurious thing you can get in a ludicrously expensive hotel? What lies behind UEFA's decision to unfurl an anti-war banner at the final of the Super Cup last night? And the Women's Rugby World Cup starts next Friday in Sunderland. I'm going to talk to one of the commentators, a Kiwi rugby fanatic who's just landed in the UK and cannot wait. And Val McDermott is our big guest after 3:30. She's going to talk about Karen Peary's bum bag, dodgy Scottish accents in audiobooks, why she spends time on holiday thinking about methods of murder and that can annoy her partner, and whether her friend Nicola Sturgeon might write a crime novel in the not-too-distant future. That's all coming up between now and 4 o'clock. A brief look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, J.D. Vance holds court with top Tories in Cotswolds thanks to George Osborne. The former Chancellor apparently set up a gathering with leading Tory politicians during the US VP's summer trip to the UK. They talked about free speech, the Ukraine war and the future of the British right over tea, it says here. The second most read story, Trump honours Some Mothers Do Have 'Em star Michael Crawford. He's always going to be called that, isn't he? But he has done so many other things. He's getting one of the highest cultural accolades in America because of the president's love of Phantom of the Opera. He was born in Salisbury, Michael Crawford. He's 83, and he was the original Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. And the most read piece on the Times website is the live blog of A-level results day. A record number of pupils have secured university and college places. And as you heard in the news, boys have pulled ahead of girls with more A-stars for the first time since 2018. All of these articles are available on thetimes.com. Get a digital subscription if you don't have one. It's very easy. You just go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Now, that is the top story of the day. A record number of pupils have secured university and college places on this A-level results day. More than a quarter of students got at least an A, with boys getting more A-stars than girls for the first time in 7 years. Now, the Times has got all the key facts online. It's well worth a look, as well as really useful guides on clearing, student loans and some of the Times' best writers on their slightly cringy university moments. There's quite a bit of alcohol involved, and I'm afraid to say some vomiting as well. But however, university doesn't need to be like that. Dr. Tim Bradshaw is the chief executive of the Russell Group of Universities. So, Dr. Bradshaw, is this a busy day for you, a happy one? What's the mood generally?
Good afternoon, Jane. Yes, it's a really busy and happy, and I would say very, very buzzy day. So congratulations in particular to all of the students who got their results today, but also those who got their hires last week. very, very good for them. And I think we ought to appreciate the fact that they probably sat some of their most challenging exams of their lives so far during one of our previous heat waves. So I know you're talking about heat in the office later on, but we should appreciate that as well. So congratulations to them all. And it's great that so many have got places in their first choice universities this year.
Yeah, I suppose it's also, we need to acknowledge these young people, some of them were 13 during the pandemic. Their adolescence has not been the most straightforward, has it?
No, they've had a really tough time. And I think that hopefully has made them also very resilient and determined to get the best out of their future education, be it at university or elsewhere. So good luck to them all.
OK, so if the top grades have increased in number, does that mean that our best universities are getting a better quality of entrant?
Yeah, it might be. I think you know, things have been improving over the years. And I think, you know, it's really good that we've got a competitive bunch of students who are willing and to do their best for their A-levels and then hopefully pick a really good solution for them. If it's at university, then they hopefully go to a good university, hopefully it's one of mine, and then go on to brilliant careers in the future. So great for them. And I think really good for the UK, for the future of the economy. If we've got great students coming through, get a good degree and get off into superb work in the future.
But can you answer the cynic who will be thinking that, frankly, your universities are just expanding to fit the huge number of pupils who miraculously do attain all of a sudden, it seems to some people, these extraordinarily high grades?
No, I don't think that's the case. I mean, there have been challenging times, obviously, during the pandemic when there were that series of teacher assessed grades and centre assessed grades where universities had to take on rather more students than they were planning for. So I think now we're used to that. We know how to deal with slightly larger intakes of students.
OK, so we shouldn't be concerned about any suggestion of grade inflation. I mean, I genuinely don't want to sound like an old FART. And I'm very aware I've got two daughters myself who took A-levels and did better than I did, because you know what? They worked harder than I did. There's no doubt about that. But you can't help but notice just how many more people get A and now the new A star.
I think one of the things I think we've seen this year is actually there are fewer entries into A-level. So it might be that the students who probably would have got maybe lower level grades haven't actually entered into A-level. So the proportions are up this year. I think that's the main reason behind it. But we shouldn't do down the students. They've worked really, really hard for their grades. And I'm really, really pleased for them. And hopefully that means they're going to go on and study hard at university too.
What do you make of the fact that we're told that schools in the northeast of England and in the West Midlands, they saw a decline in A star and A grades? This improvement isn't actually right across the board, is it? Some parts of the country are not doing as well. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, but clearly there's something not quite right there in the school system. And I know you heard the Secretary of State for Education talking about this earlier today. You know, it's really important that the UK school system functions as well as it can right across the country. So if there are problems in particular areas, that's maybe where further investment is needed, just to make sure that everybody gets up to the same level of a standard that students can achieve their potential, basically, wherever they are.
What about the state of these institutions' finances? I think you were on Times Radio not that long ago. We know that some universities are perilously close to going bust. So does the growth in the number of high achievers at A-level, does that help or hinder these places?
Well, I mean, you know, talk about university finances in the round. I mean, yes, it's a little bit challenging, much more challenging this year for all universities than it has been over the last few years. And this is, a long-term result of previous governments underinvestment in the sector and you know, not increasing tuition fees and cutting the teaching grants that universities can get, and various other policies as well that have affected underlying university finances. So yeah, it is tough at the moment for universities, but I think a message I'd just like to get across to all the students who might be listening and their parents or guardians is that universities will be doing absolutely everything they can to make sure that if they have to make cutbacks in various areas, it's not going to be something that affects the student experience. They're really, really determined to make sure that the student teaching and learning experience is really as good as it can be.
I don't know if you've had a quick look at thetimes.com, but there is an article up there already. It's in the Times magazine, which comes out on Saturday of this week. And it's an interesting article written by four young people, all in their their very early 20s, all graduates of our top universities, Oxford and Cambridge, all just describing, in some cases quite painful detail, just how tough life has been for them since they left university. They're not finding it easy to get jobs. Do you think this is a uniquely challenging time to enter the world of work?
Yeah, I think it probably is quite challenging. I mean, if you look across the Russell Group universities, I think 80% of our students go on to be in professional jobs or extend their education to masters and PhDs within 15 months of graduating. But that doesn't undermine the fact that some are definitely going to find it tough to find jobs. But remember that a degree isn't just for like the first sort of few months after you qualify. This is something that's going to be with you a lifetime. So good luck to those students. I really hope that they do find somewhere and something that they really want to enjoy doing in the future with their careers.
It is tough. It really wasn't that long ago that if you left Oxford or Cambridge with a degree of any kind, frankly, people would be biting your hand off. It just doesn't seem that way at the moment.
That's a more an economy, a current state of the economy issue, I think, than anything about universities.
Okay, so maybe I should really ask whether universities are doing everything they can to prepare graduates for the real world, because
I think they are, and I think you mentioned AI earlier as an issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we're looking at a sort of a technological and economic transformation in societies across the globe at the moment, and one of the things that particularly my university has been doing is making sure that when students leave, they've picked up the skills to be able to use these new AI tools that are coming along. Because I think that's going to be absolutely transformative for the future. So come to the university, learn those skills, learn how to develop these tools so that when you go off into the workplace, you can be ahead of the game and work out how to make the businesses or other organisations that you work with even better because you've got those skills. It's not just about your discipline, but the wider things that you can pick up whilst you're at university.
Right. And AI, I know it's important to emphasise it can present challenges, but it can also be a positive thing. Sometimes, do you think perhaps we're falling into the trap of allowing ourselves to blame AI as a reason for our failure, if indeed we are in, or relative failure, if indeed we do feel somewhat disenchanted about our prospects at, say, the age of 23?
I don't want to get into a blame game, but I think you should think of AI about any of the other digital tools that we've grown up with. I mean, I'm old enough to have gone to school when even having a pocket calculator in your hand was deemed as being a terrible thing from some quarters of society. You know, we've got to deal with that. We've got to deal with computers. We've got to deal with the internet and all the things that come with that. AI is just the next tool. And I think there are huge opportunities to be able to use those tools successfully to grow the economy, strengthen the economy for the future. So I don't think we should be in the blame game, and I don't think we can't put AI back in its box. We have to learn to work with it and really make the most of it.
Thank you very much. That's Dr. Tim Bradshaw. If you want to comment on anything he said, he is the chief executive of the Russell Group of Unis. You can contact us on 0333 003 2353. There is a comment. I'll read that in a moment, actually. By the way, thetimes.com is a great place for all your A-level needs. There is a guide for parents on clearing, advice about how you make student loans work, and Times writers, including James Marriott and Charlotte Ivers and Sebastian Payne, give details on some of their biggest university fails. I mean, it has to be said that all three of them are now doing fairly well, so they can't have been all that bad at university. John says, people have been rabbiting on about grade inflation since I did my exams over 30 years ago. Surely you know that, he says. It's natural that grades will improve. Things are getting ever more competitive. The pressure to get top grades is ever increasing. Students are therefore working harder, and schools are working harder and harder to get good grades for their students. It is just natural, says John. There are some lovely stories, actually, on thetimes.com about individual students who have excelled today, and it's just worth mentioning a young woman called Angelina Miris-Slavaska, who has got a place to read history at Merton College, Oxford. She got one A star and three A's, and she fled Ukraine in 2022, settled in the UK, with a limited grasp of the English language. I mean, what an achievement that is. And she's quoted as saying, whilst it was incredibly hard to leave my family in Ukraine, the support I have got since coming to the UK has been incredible, and I'm truly grateful to everyone who's helped me along the way. Well, congratulations to her. Much more on thetimes.com. Now, UK economic growth beat expectations over the last 3 months, expanding by 0.3%. That was more than economists had forecast, but less than in the first quarter of the year, indicating that growth is slowing down. Mohammed Jamai is the Director of Economics for the Confederation of British Industry. Mohammed, is this something to celebrate, or should we be concerned that progress appears to be slowing?
Well, thanks for having me on. So I think it's worth remembering that we and many other forecasters expected GDP to slow over the course of this year. So we had a really positive Q1, first quarter, as you said. But I think the concern we have now is partly because we're now in that lead up to the autumn budget in particular, that growth is slowing. We expect it to continue at a fairly slow pace for the remainder of this year. But what we're now really looking for and what businesses really need to see is government taking concrete action come November to help boost growth for 2026 and beyond.
Right. Concrete action, meaning from your perspective, what?
So we're just thinking about what that means. But actually, we have some examples of, in particular, tax reforms around. We have long called for full expensing to be extended to leased and rented assets. So this is a policy where if you make an investment in plants and machinery, you can claim that back from your corporation tax. We want that to be extended to leased and rented assets. That would help in construction. That would help with SMEs. It's not a policy that's cheap, but we think it will move the dial in terms of investment, business investment, which is what we desperately need for the UK economy to grow at the moment.
Okay. I mean, you say not cheap. What might it mean?
We expect it to be a sort of cost of a couple of billion pounds to deliver that policy. And the previous administration and this government have said, when fiscal conditions allowed, that they would do this. Rachel Reeves this morning has said she is committed to a budget for growth and productivity come the autumn. We need to see some of that action. I think the other thing that's worth mentioning here is we've seen some really good long-term strategies delivered by this government earlier in the year. And what we really need and what our members are calling for is some immediate action for the next few years to ensure that they are still around when we start to see the benefit of things like the industrial strategy or the 10-year infrastructure plan, for example. Like what we are being told is, you know, we will see the benefits of some of these policies in a few years, but actually we need immediate action to help lower the cost of doing business, lower the cost of hiring, increase technology adoption, and sort of have more stability when it comes to tax and regulations. And that's what our members are desperately looking for.
What I imagine your members don't want to hear is endless speculation of what might be in the budget. And we are, by the way, it's not going to stop the speculation, but we seem to have been hearing for months about potential tax rises. What impact does that have?
So, I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of any small, medium or even large business making an investment decision that is for the next 5 to 10 years, they want to see stability in the tax system in particular and in the regulatory frameworks that we have in the UK. And if you don't know what you expect, what you're going to see in 6 months' time, you would say, I'm going to sit on my hands. This business case on this investment plan can wait. Mm. And all that does is it adds to that delay that we see on business investment. And, you know, why would you not take, if you're making a commitment for 5 to 10 years, why would you not wait another 6 months and then another 6 months after that? And I think that's the danger, is that these time horizons are short. You know, if you say 6 months is not that long, but it's been happening for a number of years, post-pandemic, post-Brexit, and they are now starting to have real impacts on our growth potential in the UK. So it's providing that certainty that our members really need to allow them the confidence to invest. I think, like, if you talk to any businesses and even households at the moment, is that sentiment is pretty poor. Yeah. And actually, the growth that we saw in Q2 in the last 3 months, largely driven by government spending. It was not driven by private sector demand, like by households or by business activity. And I think it's when you dig down into the figures, that's where it's concerning.
But yes, but to the civilians amongst us when it comes to economics. If spending increases growth, why not spend more?
Because the government has committed to doing a big infrastructure plan up front for the next two years. And it's good to see in some respects that they're actually implementing that and they are spending. But a lot of that spending would come at the expense of borrowing, so or tax rises. And what we really need to see is the private sector. We need to see businesses investing and helping to grow the economy. That's the only sustainable way we will see long-term economic growth and an increase in the standard of livings. If you see government spending or households household spending going up, that can happen for a short period, but it's not sustainable in the long run because a lot of that is predicated on borrowing. Whereas business spending is the one thing that can really help shift the dial on our growth prospects and our standard of living.
Thank you very much for your contribution this afternoon. That's Mohammed Jamai, who is the Director of Economics for the Confederation of British Industry. Now, next on Times Radio, we're just going to indulge ourselves and talk about luxury travel, and I mean proper luxury travel, where money is no object and you can pay extra for a herd of wildebeest. I never quite know how to say it. Wildebeest. They don't come cheap. How much would you be willing to pay? That's next. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio. It's 24 minutes past two.
Hugo Rifkin, Monday to Thursday morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation.
Is it just me that strikes me there's a whiff of nonsense about the deal?
Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself.
Even while it drags on and as horrifying as it is, it should have been a foreign policy triumph.
Plus unique perspectives on the day's news.
There seems to be a theme here, and that is that no one knows what's going on.
Hugo Rifkin, Monday to Thursday morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Don't go. No one knows instruments like you do.
A sales assistant at Jen's music store is moving up north, so she needs to find a replacement. A musical whiz who hits all the right notes.
I bet you're going to miss this peace and quiet.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you post a sponsored job, you get a list of candidates whose CVs on Indeed match your description. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And this is from Janet, who says, my son dropped out of uni. It was a Russell Group place where he got poor pastoral support. He struggled to get a job due to a lack of a degree. He now has a job, though, and in some ways, he's a beneficiary of companies looking beyond somebody having a degree, a company who just saw that he was bright and was willing to take him on. For many people, uni is seen as a rite of passage. That's fine, but it now comes with a hefty price tag and no guarantee that it will help future job prospects in what Janet describes as a rapidly changing world. Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Not only do you not always enjoy every aspect of university, but then after 3 years or 4 years in some places, of course, or even longer if you studied medicine, you are left with quite a lot of debt to pay back at some point. Now, we're moving on to talk about luxury travel, which is out of reach for many recent graduates. But if you just keep at it, as you head towards your eighth decade, you might be able to afford a sunshine break. If you have the money, apparently these days you can get a private plunge pool, a suite, a butler and an exclusive view of East Africa's Great Migration. This is being offered by the Ritz-Carlton. It has ended up in some legal hot water over its newest lodge in Kenya. Claudia Rowan is a commissioning editor for the Times travel team. This is an extraordinary offer by the Ritz-Carlton. This is new, is it? This?
It is new, but I have to say it's not that extraordinary if you look at the wider sphere. You know, the luxury hotel scene is just... There are so many examples of over-the-top offerings and crazy prices that we see all the time.
OK, tempt me or not, as the case may be. What are they now punting at us?
So one of my colleagues arrived at the Six Senses Zigi Bay in Oman by paragliding from the nearby mountains, which
with their luggage?
I think their luggage was held for them by someone else.
Okay, right.
But it's one of your options there if you think arriving by taxi is too conventional.
Okay. You create quite an impression, presumably, at reception.
Exactly. Yeah. Another stayed at a hotel in Colorado, which had exclusive access to its own ski slopes.
Okay.
I still think, I mean, it extends to children as well, this level of luxury. I was lucky enough to stay at the Evian Spa at the Hotel Royal in Evian recently, which has an entire spa menu for kids, including a €100 fairy tale facial for children.
Okay, that's just wrong.
Yes, and I still think about the incredible family wing at the Island Shangri-La in Hong Kong, which has an enormous help-yourself pantry for children and themed rooms, which include a safari adventure suite, which will set you back around £1,000 a night.
Okay, do you get wildebeest in that?
Unfortunately not, which seems a shame if you're paying that much.
I mean, the idea of the little perishers being allowed to make merry in a pantry.
I know.
Just going in there and just grabbing whatever they want.
I know, it's mad. But people are willing to pay for these things. People want to talk about crazy holiday experiences over dinner.
Well, we don't know who these people are. I mean, although you have hinted that you've been to some lovely places, I think recent graduates are going to be wondering, Claudia, how they get a job like yours as commissioning editor for the Times Travel Team. What's your journey been to get here, just out of interest?
I didn't study journalism, but I studied English at uni and edited my student paper and then was lucky enough to get onto a journalism grad scheme.
Okay, well, I'm not asking to be nosy, but I do think that's really significant that you shared that information, because people do need to know. I think getting your A-levels feels like an incredible achievement, and it is.
Exactly. It's a really tough market at the moment for recent grads. I know this because I have younger brothers who are going into this world as well and faced with these very difficult job prospects. So it's a hard time.
It is a hard time. And I think anyone who is tempted to be unpleasant about young people wrestling with the future, I think you maybe need to just acknowledge it's not been easy. And I really mean it. These people getting their A-level results today were 13 back in 2020.
I know. They've been through so much.
It's not been a barrel of laughs, has it?
No, but fingers crossed it
will. Are your younger brothers jealous of you?
Oh, I don't know. Perhaps.
Yeah. Well, send them to that place with the wildebeest.
I know. I wish I could go there too.
Okay. We both actually agreed off air, Claudia and I, that we secretly both just wanted to go to Greece, and we'd happily just go anywhere in Greece pretty much.
Mm.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise. That's Claudia Rowan, commissioning editor for the Times Travel Team. I mean, paragliding to reception at a hotel, I don't think that will ever be beaten. Thank you for sharing that information with me. You're listening to Times Radio. Next, should you be allowed to stop work if it's just too hot? Here are the headlines just after 2:30. Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Officials say there was a powerful sense of unity during a meeting between Sir Keir Starmer and Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street this morning. Number 10 says they discussed Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Alaska tomorrow. The Times understands that Russia and the US have discussed an idea for ending the war that mirrors Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Ukrainian MP Lisa Yasko says compromise will almost certainly be required.
We should demand a ceasefire, but we cannot reject everything. With all other very hard questions, we need to have a plan. How do we discuss this? And hopefully it will be made. But I'm not very optimistic about all of this.
The man accused of driving into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade is facing an additional 24 charges, including assault against two babies. More than 130 people were injured when Paul Doyle allegedly drove his Ford Galaxy into a crowd of supporters on May the 26th. Former world snooker champion Graham Dott is to stand trial next year over allegations of child sexual abuse. The 48-year-old is accused of two charges relating to a girl and boy of primary school age between 1993 and 1996 and 2006 and 2010, respectively. His lawyer told the High Court in Glasgow he denies the charges. And the Tories say the economy is in a period of stagnation after figures showed economic growth in the UK had slowed. GDP expanded by 0.3% in the 3 months to June. That's down from 0.7% in the previous 3 months. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
After our conversation with the CBI economist, Michael has WhatsApp to say, please don't forget small businesses. The social care sector has 1,800 SMEs employing nearly 2 million people. Wow. That sector has been decimated by NMW increases. The workers' rights bill will also force many people into bankruptcy as the sector suffers from a very high sickness rate. We pay all our carers all we can, but 80% of the sector is government underfunded, says Michael. Quite like to know, but can you just explain what you mean exactly, Michael? I feel as though I don't know enough about that subject, but I absolutely hear you on how tough it is to run an SME right now, and that social care sector, so, so important. Steve says on the heat issue, I just want to shout out to everybody working outside this week. It is not pleasant. I've just pruned a large English lavender hedge and it is absolutely sweltering, which is a reminder to me, he says. I want to tell all Times Radio listeners, prune your lavender now. OK, I can't make that any clearer. That's from Steve the gardener, who's a regular contributor. Hope you're well, Steve. He is currently at work in sweltering Maidenhead. Mm. I'm going to talk about the temperature in the workplace in a moment. Of course, we're talking largely about offices, and that's just, we're so fortunate to sit in an air-conditioned studio, and the office is beautiful, isn't it, Callum?
Absolutely gorgeous. Nowhere else I'd rather be.
Well, actually, in these temperatures, there isn't, because somebody knows what they're doing with the old aircon. It's absolutely fabulous out there. What have you got between 4 and 7?
We have got some of the usual stuff, I think, is quite exciting today, actually. So we've got things like our business update and all that kind of stuff. But after 6, our friends today. We've been struggling with the branding of this because it's usually Pienaar and Friends. So we've gone through various iterations this week of Callum and Co, McDonald and Mates.
Clan McDonald?
Oh, that's very good.
You can have that.
I'll write that one down. That'll be today's one. Thanks, Jane. I knew I could count on you. We've got Kirsty Buchanan, who was a special advisor at Number 10, working with Theresa May and Alan Tolhurst, the Politics Home chief reporter. And I think actually one of the interesting things that we'll get at here, Robert Jenrick has posted his latest video, which he is becoming famous for.
Oh, yeah.
This one is from...
When you say famous, I mean, let's just be honest about
renowned
that.
Renowned for.
Brand
Jenrick.
I'm going to run up and down my local high street over the weekend with a big picture of the man and stick it under people's noses and say, who's this?
I tell you, that would go viral. Get somebody to film that, Jane. It'll be okay. All over the internet.
Right.
His latest one is from Cali. So we'll discuss, and it's obviously about immigration, we'll discuss that, but actually we want to consider what politicians are doing during this recess, because he's there, Chris Philp from the Conservatives has been there as well. What actually is the most effective way to use recess? The kind of conventional thinking is you have more time in your constituency, you run more surgeries. In fact, I saw the First Minister of Scotland was doing a local surgery, which I thought was quite a hilarious little thing. Imagine showing up and bothering John Swinney about the potholes. Anyway.
But why not?
That's what he's there for.
The beauty of the British system, isn't it?
Exactly that. And so we'll be doing a bit on how is best to spend your recess as a politician. Of course, we are continuing to consider the Alaska summit, which is happening tomorrow. Among our guests, former UK ambassador to Ukraine Lee Turner. We want to get at some of the detail of what this summit may actually result in. So there's been talk already on the radio station today about the minerals, potential for a minerals deal. We'll be looking at economic sanctions as well today. And I think a crucial part of this that we're keen to reflect on the programme today, there are 1,000 Ukrainian refugees in Alaska. And how are they feeling about Putin arriving on their doorstep?
That's interesting.
We want to try and just consider their, you know, they're working, some of them in fisheries and in bakeries, and obviously it's been a huge change of life, oh my goodness, on the other side of the world from where they were in Ukraine. So actually, how are they feeling about the dictator arriving that invaded their country? And as part of our coverage too, we'll speak to the Times' Maxim Tucker, who has been has got an exclusive interview. It's in the paper, you can read it in the world section of thetimes.com just now, with a colonel in the Ukrainian army that Putin is scared of, and I think I'm a bit scared of him too. And he's
I read that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. His name is Andrei Beletsky. And he's a controversial figure, lots of sort of allegations of racism and anti-Semitism that he denies, and how he sort of treats his soldiers, although Maxim has spoken to those under his command who seem full of praise for him.
I think that, what else are they going to say?
Well, exactly that. And he seems to be incredibly successful at running these various divisions of the Ukrainian army. A fascinating person who, in many ways, I'm glad I haven't met. But on the part of Ukraine, we're probably glad that he's got something to do with their fighting effort.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting couple of days. Let Callum be your guide between 4 o'clock and 7 here on Times Radio. Now, heat alerts have been extended as the fourth heat wave of the summer continues. But now we hear that Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, is one of five Cabinet Ministers who would quite like to introduce new rules about working conditions in hot weather. Josh McNicholas is from Evaluate Environmental Health and Safety. Josh, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. But then I'm in a beautiful air-conditioned environment. And I just need to own that. I am very lucky to be here. What are, if indeed there are any rules in the UK around working in hot weather? I mean, is there a point at which any employee could just say, no, I'm too hot, I'm going home?
It's a funny one, because the fundamental is there are no rules around kind of hot weather and what is too hot. We have minimum temperatures that the workplace needs to be for indoor and outdoor, but we have absolutely no legal maximum temperature. The law is essentially workplaces must be reasonable under health and safety rules, and employers are expected to conduct risk assessments and follow guidance around thermal comfort. But, I mean, without any hard, clear rules in place, that's extremely ambiguous for employees to know what they can expect from an employer and what's fair to request, and from employers as a business to know what they need to provide to be doing well. Essentially, at the moment, it's almost whatever you think's fair.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm assuming that you go into lots of different workplaces.
Yes.
And
yes,
you presumably have borne the brunt of many different kinds of temperatures and environments. What can you tell me about what you've seen and felt?
So I think this really feeds into the, I wouldn't say there's an argument against introducing something, as I think everyone wants clear guidance and rules in place. It's how it's executed, because we work with a lot of manufacturing companies, and we also work with a lot of office-based companies. And the temperatures in a manufacturing environment, for example, can range wildly depending on what they're doing compared to an office-based environment, which is why I think a blanket one rule fits all isn't necessarily the approach here, because it's not feasible for a kitchen, a restaurant, a glass blowing factory to have the same rules, for example, as a studio like yours or the office like I'm in, which is where there needs to be not only clear guidance around what is considered too hot, but what needs to be, and this is what we end up speaking to a lot of our customers about, is what does a risk assessment look like, for example, for thermal comfort and hot working environments? You know, what should that include? What does the software they use, like ours, you know, how should that support it?
But, I mean, you're right, of course, no workplace is exactly the same as any other. But presumably, if you are in, say, a glassworks, as you mentioned, then you, as a responsible employer, are duty-bound to supply the right equipment, to allow breaks, to give plenty of fluids. I mean, all that would be appalling if that wasn't happening, surely.
Yeah, there'd be a very interesting court case if that didn't happen. And you are guided, certainly, on what to provide for your employees and the environment to create. And it's interesting because almost the hotter the working environment, the more clear it does become. The ambiguity is very much at the level of workplaces like ours, which for the most part of the country make up an awful lot of the SMEs, you know, that fuel the economy. And I think the best way to look at it for those that are struggling with this at the moment, are wondering how they can combat it, is if we were to take a broader look around Europe, say compare what Spain do to what Germany do. Now, Spain is a naturally hot country.
Yeah.
They have very clear policies on when it's too hot to work, if it's simply a normal day, what needs to be provided to outdoor workers, indoor workers, and then if there's an orange or red kind of heat warning, there's almost a hardline work on most activity unless it's necessary, whereas you look at Germany, which is much more reflective of our climate, they take a tiered approach, which I think is the sensible way to do it. I don't think we should be looking at this as a blanket application. It's a tiered approach of normal working conditions, indoor, outdoor, you know, apply sensible rules, which is essentially what we're told, regardless of the temperature now, and then have a three-tiered system beyond that, like Germany do. Although they don't set, even at 35 degrees for indoor working, they don't say that is too hot to work. And yourself, me, anybody out there would agree that you're not sitting in an office at 35 degrees.
Well, no.
That's ridiculous.
No, it would be unthinkable. I mean, genuinely, that would be painful.
It would. And like I say, even Germany, there is no hard line at that. And then you drift into kind of fatigue issues with staff, health, safety issues with staff collapsing, lapse of concentration. So I think a tiered approach is an achievable sensible approach.
But I'm just thinking, I mean, we've been talking a little bit about the challenges of running an SME at the moment in Britain, all sorts of problems. I mean, not least the increase in employers' NI, that's just one example. Growth, we're constantly being told we need to grow more, we need to grow the economy. Productivity needs to be on the up as well. I mean, how can any of that be achieved when employees will have the right to slack off when it gets too hot?
And that's the question, isn't it? Because that's what a lot of the countries worried about, and certainly from our customers, that's what we hear as well. It's not an unwillingness to do this. It's a concern in getting caught up in red tape, having to bear the cost of it, not only from a lack of productivity, as in your employees can go home, as in having to provide what some may consider beyond unreasonable accommodation, because a blanket approach has been set, which is again why I go back to, and when we speak to our customers who they're running risk assessments through our software about extreme heat at the moment, for example, the consensus that I get is the tiered approach is a great first step to providing that guidance for business and knowing employees knowing where they stand in terms of what is unreasonable. And I genuinely believe, knowing, being a person that has worked in the UK, knowing the public and knowing our customers, when you hit that tier three of a three-tier guidance system, you're probably going to be sending your employees home anyway. If we look at, again, Germany with their 35 degrees is tier three.
We
got sent home yesterday in this office early, and it was nowhere near that temperature. It was just simply unbearable. So I think a more solid guidance system with a common sense approach is a much clearer way forward.
Okay, it's interesting that you were sent home. Just very quickly, Josh, people working outside, like Steve the gardener, who sent me a message a bit earlier, I mean, they are really up against it. I mean, agricultural workers, people picking fruit or whatever they might be doing at this time of year, I mean, they honestly are not free to just go home, are they? And that fundamentally is unfair. I mean, it's also risky health-wise.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, even in my young years, I did some landscaping, and I suffered a few summers myself, which is again why I think there needs to be an almost indoor outdoor approach, because what needs to be done outdoors needs to be done there. I genuinely believe for outdoor working, there has to be a limit in which people can draw the line for a safety perspective, because it's just not fair. But beyond that, if we go with this three-tier approach, on tier two, what would be considered reasonable accommodation for indoor working wouldn't be the same as what's considered reasonable
outdoors. Josh, grateful to you. Thank you very much indeed. Anthony says, in the early 2000s, the UAE had a rule which prohibited working outdoors when the temperature was above 45 Celsius. However, the official temperature never seemed to exceed 45 Celsius, which is presumably why so many of the skyscrapers were built so quickly. Anthony's currently in Cardiff, where it's 21.4 Celsius, which you have to say is manageable. Now, the number of arrests at the Palestine Action protest on Saturday beat the record previously set at the poll tax riots back in 1990. So, as the mass arrests are processed, who is behind Palestine Action, and was the government right to prescribe it as a terrorist organisation? Today's edition of the Story podcast looks at that in depth. Luke Jones has been talking to Tom Witherow.
It was founded by a lady called Huda Amori. It's in her early 30s. She was born in Bolton to a Palestinian father and an Iraqi mother. And I suppose her entry into this world of activism came through the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which is the relative to Palestine Action, a moderate protest-driven group arguing for Palestinian statehood and so on. But over time, she felt that that whole movement, which of course has continued for many years, if not decades, had not had the impact and was not actually having any effect on the ground in the Middle East.
Thank you. The Story podcast is available now on all good podcast platforms. I find the easiest way to get it is on the Times Radio app. You actually may have joined us just as Jane and I were talking. You did. Apparently nobody heard it. Oh, thank goodness. Ryan's just assured me. Let's bring in Pat, who's in Northern Ireland, who says, my lavender bushes, I have three, are all twice their normal size this year, and they're covered with bees, but I won't be pruning just yet. Well, Pat, when it comes around to pruning in Northern Ireland, you let us know when you've done it. I was passing on some public information earlier on from Steve the gardener. Right, it's Times Radio. Jane Mulkerrin's lies ahead. Can't wait. It's 10 to 3.
Alexis Conran on Times Radio with Blacklane, the global chauffeur service. Embark on a luxury journey with Alexis every weekend as he unpacks the weekly news agenda and investigates the issues behind the headlines. Plus, don't miss Arriving in Style, your expert guide to all the best events this summer, whether you're staying local or travelling further afield. Alexis Conran, every Saturday and Sunday afternoon from 1 on Times Radio with Blacklane, the global chauffeur service. Arrive better with Blacklane. Download the app to book now.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
To whoever finds this letter, my car broke down. There is nothing nearby. And I've already eaten my meal deal sandwich. Please tell my wife that I love her and that she was right. This jacket isn't waterproof. Signed, Daniel S.
Oh, actually, scrap that. Green flag's just arrived. Blimey, less than an hour.
Local rescue, nationwide. Nothing beats near. Green flag.
On average, we get to breakdowns in under an hour based on app and phone callouts combined between July 24 and June 25.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Quite nice to hear from you about your gardens. Kate just says one of our rose bushes is looking fabulous, but I'm not sure what we've done right. Yes, I can relate to that, Kate, because sometimes some of my roses look fabulous and I'm just doing nothing. I'm doing nothing at all. It's a mysterious world, gardening. Do you know anything about it, Jane Mulcair?
Less than nothing, Jane Garvey.
No, thank you.
Less than nothing. I come home every evening and think, God, that front bush is really out of control. Hope my mum can come and stay soon and sort it out.
Yeah, exactly. Jane finds herself the associate editor at the Times magazine.
And we don't know anything, how I did that either.
No, that is a world of mystery. Jane is also a regular host here on Times Radio, and you're on this weekend.
I am, at 10 till 1 on Sunday.
Yeah, and what have you got?
We have got Cleo Watson, former to Boris Johnson, and of course Bonkbuster author now, and Robert Crampton. They will be my fabulous news panel. We've got Dolly Alderton, the brilliant Dolly Alderton.
She's a legend.
She will be our big guest at 12:30, and then in between that we'll have loads of other stuff.
Is she talking about, because she has written Pride and Prejudice?
She is writing, well, yeah, she's adapted Pride and Prejudice. They're in the middle of filming now. She has told us a little bit about Pride and Prejudice, but there's a lot she has to keep under her bonnet until closer to the time, because Netflix are very, very secretive.
All right, well, I can't wait for that. So the magazine, the Times magazine, is, as ever, packed with meaty goodness. The cover is very funny this week. Just describe it, please.
So the cover is a sort of mock-up of Hello magazine cover, because Rosie Nixon, who was the former editor-in-chief of Hello, has written a fantastic piece about her 15 years of editing Hello magazine. So we've got a picture of her with Joan Collins on the front, Rosie holding a lovely goblet of something, and inside my fabulous world as a Hello editor. Yeah, it's a brilliant piece. Rosie says, wherever she goes to dinner parties, you know, the thing everyone wants to know is, what was it really like? What was it really like behind the scenes? Yeah. You know, there's all these glossy pictures of weddings and births, and, you know, and everyone wants to know, was it as glamorous as it looks? What was going on behind the scenes? So she's written this brilliant piece about, I mean, just, it's ridiculous. I mean, she's got this great anecdote about ferrying the Osbournes around in Hawaii for Jack Osborne's wedding, and trying to sort of, a lot of it is trying to evade the paparazzi the whole time.
I mean, the Hello magazine, I regard it as the hair dyer's friend. So when I'm at the salon, amazing, people will be really startled to hear that I dye my hair. But when I go, it just keeps you company for that very important 20 minutes when it's all just taking...
It absolutely taking does. It absolutely does. And it's brilliant. I mean, she's got stories about the elephant that gate crushed Sam Branson's wedding.
But it didn't eat the cake.
Yes, it ate the cake. Being at Robbie Williams' house, you know, when he was about to have his secret wedding, you know, a secret wedding for about 800 guests flying in to LA. But it's really interesting, because the time when Rosie was at the helm of Hello, she only left that job a couple of years ago. And it was a time, I think, when the young royals were obviously incredibly prominent and glamorous, and people were really interested in the royal family for the first time, probably in quite a long time, which, you know, really helped magazines like Hello as well, because there was a huge amount of interest. But, you know, since then, you know, the relationships between celebrities and the media has changed, and it started to change during Rosie's time, because, you know, the digital world, but also getting scoops is much harder, because obviously with social media, celebrities want to tell their own story directly to their fans. So there isn't that sort of need for an intermediary to sort of have your wedding pictures or your baby pictures. You know, now celebrities sort of like to do it all themselves as well. So it's a completely different landscape. I don't think that, you know, people would be... The exclusives certainly aren't worth the money that they were worth 15, 20 years ago.
I'm afraid that's true. Now, I mentioned earlier, actually, the feature on the young people who've graduated. I mean, these aren't just any young people. They are incredibly gifted academically. Young people who graduated from Oxford and Cambridge, they're 23. I think they're all 23. And they're just writing in the magazine about the challenges of being 23, even with a great degree these days. There's no route to immediate success. But then I suppose you could argue there never has been.
No, I think that's true. I think, certainly when I left one of the two Oxbridge universities, I applied for a lot of jobs and I didn't get a sniff of any of them. I didn't even get a sniff of any traineeships. That was a very long time ago, far too long ago than I'd like to remember. But I think it's always been hard, even with a good degree, to get the jobs you want. But I think it's definitely harder.
Yeah.
I think it's harder now.
I sometimes think that we now put a lot of emphasis on settling into university and the challenges of freshers and everything else. But we don't really talk very much about how depleted you can feel after university, and those early sort of 22, 23, 24, 25 can sometimes be quite difficult for people.
Yeah, I imagine that people feel quite lost because I ended up going to journalism school. And that was a really good decision because I actually got training, you know, for the thing I wanted to do. And then I did have jobs, job offers when I came out of it. But it meant I also had a plan at the end of university that I was going to move to London. You know, I was getting a flat and whatever. But I think if you're applying for lots of jobs, many of them will be moving home to live with their parents again for the first time in 3 years. And it's a quite a discombobulating time, isn't it? You sort of don't know what's next.
Yeah, some of them do spend the 14-week holiday in the summer also at home with their parents.
Are you speaking from experience there, Joe?
No, not bitter experience, just experience. And also the Cotswolds are explored.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine there's a fair few people out there who would like to pay 50 grand to avoid running into J.D. Vance and his 23-vehicle motorcade in the Cotswolds. But should you wish to holiday like the Vice President in the Cotswolds, we have got the guide for you. We've spoken to a woman called Anne Harrod-Jones, who runs a luxury property concierge company in the Cotswolds. It's incredible. The prices people will pay and the things that they will pay for, it's unbelievable. She says she wants to organise a Caribbean-themed circus-themed party for a 40th birthday for one of their guests with a drum band, tiki bar, circus tent, fire breathers, sword juggling artists and performers. They said they asked her if she could get some cannons so they could fire people out of them, like in The Wolf of Wall Street. She thought it was a joke. And then days before the party, they said, well, what about the cannons?
Of course.
She said, on reflection, I think that's something I can't really help you with.
Well, we all have our limits, I guess. Do you know what? I acknowledge that the Cotswolds are very pretty. What I don't like is the notion that is so-called quintessential England. Because the Peak District, for example.
Exactly.
You're familiar with that.
I'm very familiar.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I thought that Southern Countryside really wasn't very impressive until, well, I quite like the South Downs now because I live next to them. But, I mean, I still think the Peak District is better. Yes. Than anything down here.
Yeah, I know. I think you're right. I think there are so many beautiful parts of England, and we shouldn't assume that that's what England looks like just because it's that special coloured stone with the lovely pubs and
just like to clarify that wasn't an invitation to the Vice President from the Peak District.
Buxton wants you now, JD. What's that other lovely place? Bakewell.
Bakewell.
Yes. Both thought of the tart there just at the same time. Right. It's Times Radio. It's almost 3 o'clock. Get your Times magazine as part of your Saturday Times bundle. There is so much to read this week.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is 3 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey with you until four here on Times Radio. In the next hour, we will look ahead to the Alaska summit between Putin and Trump. We'll talk about therapy dogs on trains and we'll hear from the crime writer Val McDermid. Get her view on Karen Piri's bum bags. What does she really think? That's the big talking point of the week, isn't it? There's no doubt about it. Here's the news at three, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has held talks with Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street the day before Donald Trump meets Vladimir Putin in Alaska. The Prime Minister and other European leaders say they're concerned about Ukraine being sidelined during negotiations about its own future. The Times understands that Russia and the US have discussed an idea for ending the war that mirrors Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Catherine Philp, the Times' World Affairs editor, says it's not a promising suggestion.
In terms of a lasting peace, the West Bank is a fairly dismal model if you think of the fact that it has not brought peace, it's not ended any bloodshed, and it remains the world's most long-standing and intractable occupation. So, I mean, if that is the terms in which it is being framed or even thought of, that is not encouraging.
The man accused of driving into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade is facing an additional 24 charges, including assault against two babies. More than 130 people were injured when Paul Doyle allegedly drove his Ford Galaxy into a crowd of supporters on May the 26th. A Times investigation has discovered the widespread sale and consumption of drugs at one of the UK's biggest music festivals. An undercover reporter at Boomtown Festival near Winchester witnessed one dealer accepting contactless payments for drugs. Fiona Meesham is the chair of criminology at the University of Liverpool. She also founded The Loop, which offers drug checking services at festivals. She's told Times Radio she's not surprised.
On average, about half of the people who go to UK festivals will be taking drugs. People will be hiding them where they aren't allowed to search. They'll be hiding them in their camping equipment. And so, for example, at this festival, it's a 5-day camping event. So everybody coming on site will have a tent and other camping equipment. And you have to have a trade-off between how much you search in each individual versus making sure that you don't have a backlog of queues for public safety purposes.
Boys have outperformed girls at A-level for the first time in 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been opening their results, with a record number getting a place at their first-choice university. Owen will study maths at Nottingham after getting an A star, an A and a B. He's paid tribute to his teachers at North Birmingham Academy.
It was a lot of effort. I had lots of support on my teachers the whole time, just always keeping me working hard. Always there to give me support, extra help on the marking and everything. So I'm really glad. This is a bit of a team effort, and yeah, I'm really happy with how I've done.
A Glasgow schoolgirl who designed a solar-powered backpack with an electric blanket for the homeless is on Times Magazine's first Girls of the Year list. 13-year-old Rebecca Young came up with the idea a couple of years ago after being moved by the sight of people sleeping rough in freezing weather. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
There's no doubt it is eagerly anticipated, that summit in Alaska in the United States tomorrow between Putin and Trump. And we are very much hoping to talk to a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal on that very soon here on Times Radio. We're also going to celebrate the idea of a therapy dog on a train service. That sounds interesting. First, though, has UEFA gone political? A banner with the message, "Stop killing children, stop killing civilians," was rolled out on the pitch last night before the Super Cup game between Spurs and Paris Saint-Germain. It was in Italy. Martin Ziegler is chief sports reporter for The Times. I spoke to him earlier and asked whether he was surprised by what had happened last night.
Slightly. I mean, there a couple of days ago, they did announce that they were going to be supporting Médecins Sans Frontières in some of their work in Gaza. So not totally, and they do tend to stay away from anything too political. I mean, but as I've spoken to people there today, they're insisting this isn't political. This is just a message about humanity, similar to the Olympic truce, which the International Olympic Committee holds during their games when they appeal for peace across the world. So it's, I suppose, what's political and what's social and what's sort of, as somebody I spoke to there said, what's common sense?
Well, the message, stop killing children, stop killing civilians, you read that now and you think that clearly is a direct reference to the events in Gaza. Now, they may say it isn't, but that's how I would interpret it, and I imagine that's how many other people would interpret it. But, of course, I don't want children or civilians to be killed anywhere in the world. Is it just coincidence that it was Spurs playing in that match last night and they have links to the Jewish community in London?
I think it was complete coincidence. I mean, I think if you speak to people in UEFA, they had refugee children from several conflict zones, including Ukraine. Now, obviously, Ukraine is an important one for UEFA because two of their members, Russia and Ukraine, are involved in that conflict. Russia is banned from international football and European competitions that UEFA holds. So they could point to the fact that Ukraine is also an important conflict zone for them.
But Russia's banned. Israel isn't banned, is it?
No, Israel's not banned. And in fact, an Israeli head of their football association was elected to UEFA's executive committee in April. So it's not banned at all. And it looks like, certainly there's enough support from people within UEFA for one of their members to be elected to an important position.
Right. So if UEFA really wanted to make a stand, then they could ban Israel from competitions and they could do something about that member of the board. But they've chosen to do neither of those two things.
No, that's correct. I mean, I think they prefer to stay away from excluding countries generally. I think, I mean, the issue around Russia was more the fact that other countries refused to play them. For example, England and the Scandinavian country have made it clear they will not play any Russian teams. So that created a problem for UEFA, and I think they had no choice but to exclude Russia. I don't think they particularly wanted to, because I think they prefer to take the option is that they won't exclude anybody, and that includes Israel.
All this happens, of course, after Mo Salah of Liverpool appeared to, well, he did criticise UEFA last week when UEFA referenced the killing of a Palestinian footballer who died in an Israeli attack. And Salah responded, "Can you tell us how he died, where and why?" Now, that was pretty pointed from him. He obviously feels strongly about it. He's a very significant footballing figure. Did UEFA feel under pressure after Mo Salah did that?
Well, he was certainly calling out UEFA then for you know, putting out this tribute to the player without saying the fact he was killed by an Israeli attack. UEFA, they say that this banner and this whole plan of having refugee children was devised and planned and set up well in advance of Mo Salah doing that. And they say it's completely unconnected.
Do you believe that?
No, I do believe the fact that the plan for the refugee children has been in the works for some time. I guess they might have been stung by Mo Salah saying that, but I don't believe that they've reacted, oh, let's do this, ship in some refugee children. I think that would be super cynical in the timescales involved and the people involved. But, I don't think that's probably right. Likely either.
Okay, but I guess the cynic in me would think it wouldn't take long to knock up a banner.
No, of course it wouldn't take long to knock up a banner, but that's what they say.
Okay, well, do they share their approach, their slightly ambivalent approach to politics with FIFA, the world governing body of football?
Yes, I think it's quite similar. I mean, we have situations where FIFA is facing constant calls from the Palestinian FA to kick Israel out of football. But they've sort of taken this difficult and precarious balancing act where they've been looking at the issue for the best part of 20 years now without actually taking any decisions on that. And we've both seen both with Gianni Infantino and his predecessor, Sepp Blatter. They're constantly involved in calls for peace around the world and various conflicts. Gianni Infantino has even spoken about using football to try and bring peace to the Middle East. So they speak a lot about peace, but because I think it sort of suits their desire to be seen as sort of important people. But it's when it comes to actual politics, they try and, as you say, stay on this precarious balancing act.
That is the voice of Martin Ziegler, who is chief sports reporter for The Times. Now, all eyes on Alaska tomorrow. Vladimir Putin has praised Donald Trump's attempts to end the Ukraine war as energetic and sincere. The Russian leader made these remarks ahead of that summit tomorrow, suggesting he might be open to a new treaty on nuclear weapons between the US and Russia. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky went to Downing Street for talks with Sir Keir Starmer this morning, and they focused on security guarantees ahead of the summit. Matthew Luxmore is a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Matthew, officially, Western leaders have to say how confident they are in Donald Trump's efforts at diplomacy and indeed how grateful they are to him. But the truth is that behind the scenes, their knees must be knocking, surely.
Yeah, I think they're very worried about a kind of Yalta 2.0 where Trump and Putin get together and do what Putin's been dreaming about for a long time, which is kind of hashing out the fate of Europe's security infrastructure and also the fate of Ukraine. Now, the Ukrainians and the Europeans have been really kind of getting together over the last few days to try and prevail upon the American side to avoid giving Putin a sense that they're willing to do that or indeed kind of making any agreements on anything of that sort. in Alaska, and Zelensky has made clear there's not going to be an agreement on Ukraine without Ukraine. And luckily, it does seem like the Trump administration and the White House has made this clear, and Trump as well. They're downplaying expectations. They're making clear that they understand the European position. And this is a kind of feel-out exercise. It's a case of getting together with Putin. And I think from Trump's perspective, trying to gauge how serious Putin is about making peace.
Who will be in the room, apart from the interpreters? Will it be Trump with Witkoff in the room with Putin?
Well, we don't know exactly, but it seems from reporting that we've seen that the initial meeting will be Putin and Trump with translators. Then I think they'll bring in a bigger delegation, you know, Witkoff, Rubio, etc., you know, Lavrov. And then I think they're due to give a press conference. But I think the initial stage will be the way Trump likes to do things, and certainly the way Putin wants it as well, which is the two of them speaking together. And we know that in previous summits, you know, there was some confusion about note takers, whether Trump was even taking notes or whether anyone was taking notes of the meeting, for example, in Helsinki. Mm. But I think in this situation, we're hoping that everything will be documented and recorded.
Yes, I mean, the idea that there won't be note takers, I mean, this is madness, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Trump definitely has this style of, it's a personal style. He believes in personal agency and meeting with other world leaders and making decisions that are very, very important to make over the phone or through, you know, back channels, diplomacy, through other representatives of their government. And for Putin, you know, it's a chance to influence Trump to try and convince him of Russia's position and perhaps to deliver a very long historical monologue about what he perceives to be the history of Russia and Ukraine relations. So Putin will be trying to kind of bring Trump around to his perspective on things. And I think Trump will be trying to get Putin at least to agree to a ceasefire.
Right. How likely is it that a ceasefire is the result, an immediate ceasefire, is the result of tomorrow's summit, not even featuring Ukraine?
Well, look, I think the important thing is that Putin's not coming to Alaska to make peace in Ukraine. Putin has talked, and his administration has talked for a very long time about the fact that they want to improve relations with the US. They want to strike various economic deals. They had Kirill Dmitriev, who is very versed in this stuff, fluent English speaker, flying to Washington, D.C., to, you know, talk a good game about, you know, striking economic deals with Russia. Putin has said we have far larger reserves of rare earths than Ukraine, which, of course, struck a deal with the U.S., giving them access to some of this stuff in Ukraine. So I think Putin wants to come to Alaska and say, look, the war in Ukraine is a complex thing. It's something you're not going to fully understand because, you know, we have centuries of conflict with Ukraine. We're trying to sort it out. We will make peace ultimately. But look, there's all this other stuff that we can talk about. You know, there's nuclear deals, as you mentioned earlier. This is something that might be agreed on, like renewing the New START treaty,
yeah,
or something like this. But he also, I think Putin understands he needs to bring something to the table, some kind of gesture that he needs to make Trump think that he's not, you know, dragging his feet over Ukraine. So a ceasefire might possibly be something that he offers up, or perhaps pause to the bombardment of Ukrainian cities. But I'm very skeptical about that. I think it's going to be probably something in a different domain.
I mean, shouldn't we still be outraged, really, that a despot like Putin, who invaded another sovereign country, is getting the opportunity to parade on the international stage? There couldn't be a bigger one tomorrow in the United States. I mean, it is all bizarre, isn't it?
I mean, it's incredible how much things have changed in the past 3.5 years, right? You know, Putin has an arrest warrant out in his name from the ICC. He was definitely seen widely in Europe and beyond as a war criminal 2 years ago. And now he gets a chance to go to Alaska and meet on a U.S. Military base, as far as we know, with the U.S. president. It's quite an incredible turn of events. It's in many ways a result of Trump's efforts and his style of negotiation as well. But I think for Putin, we'll see this as a chance to show as you mentioned, that he is not an international pariah, despite the fact that they've waged this war for 3.5 years. And he's not someone that, you know, cannot leave his own country at risk of arrest.
And Matthew, a listener called Scott is asking about this idea, I certainly read about it in the Times yesterday on thetimes.com, about the idea that Ukraine would have effectively a kind of West Bank style occupation. Is that honestly a possibility?
I mean, I'm not quite sure which exact part of Ukraine your listener is referring to, but I think Trump has made quite clear that there won't be a discussion over what he called last week, you know, possible land swaps between the two countries. The Europeans and the Ukrainians have made very clear to the American side that this is not something that they're going to agree to. So anything that is agreed upon between Trump and Putin is not something that is going to be kind of legitimized.
Right. So people don't need to be alarmed that Russia won't effectively be allowed to control the area it already occupies in Ukraine, in a sort of copy of what happens in the West Bank?
Well, I think people should be very worried about that, because that's what's happening right now. I mean, Russia de facto controls the territory that it is occupied, right?
Is there a chance that they could simply be left there, allowed to carry on in much the same way?
That is the status quo right now, right? So absent any agreement on Ukraine, that will continue to be the case. Russia controls and has ultimate control over the territory it currently occupies in Ukraine. Ukraine has been unable to oust the Russians out of that territory. So what Ukraine is hoping for is a deal that allows it to claw back some of that territory. Absent any peace deal, that is the situation right now. Russia will keep controlling that area unless their army collapses, which, again, has not been the case since Ukraine launched a big counteroffensive in 2023.
Just in brief, if you can, Matthew, what would be the best outcome tomorrow for Chancellor Merz and President Macron and Prime Minister Keir Starmer and President Zelensky?
Well, I think the best outcome would be if Trump gets Putin to commit to a softening of his hardline position on Ukraine. Publicly, Russia's demands on Ukraine have not changed since the war started. Essentially, it's Ukraine's disarmament, it's its neutral political status, a Russian veto over its foreign policy, an abandonment of aspirations to join NATO, and giving up the territory that Russia already controls, and ideally for Putin, a lot more than that as well, including all of Donbass. So I think a positive outcome for the Europeans and the Ukrainians would be if Putin softens some of his positions. He says, look, we're willing perhaps to, you know, bring our forces out of this part of Ukraine, which would be a great scenario, I think, for Ukraine. Or we're willing to allow Ukraine to, you know, join NATO ultimately under these conditions. So that already would be some progress compared to the situation we've had so far, which is kind of very intransigent Russia. And then, of course, they bring that to the Europeans, and hopefully then discussions can begin about how that will look in practice.
Thank you for your time, Matthew. Matthew Luxmore is a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Now, Off Air with Jane and Fee is a podcast that you can get. You can get it. Just think of that. It comes your way at about 6 o'clock, Monday to Thursday. It includes just a range of conversations about an incredible range of topics, it has to be said. It usually features Fee Glover and myself, but this week Jane Mulcairns is being Fee. The off-air podcast also includes our big interview of the day. So yesterday you will have heard, as part of your off-air package, Nicola Sturgeon, the former First Minister of Scotland. And here she is telling me about the breakdown in the relationship, the working relationship, I should say, she had with her predecessor, Alex Salmond.
I've tried not to rewrite history. He was my mentor. He was a very close friend. It's for others to judge, but I would say we were one of the most successful political partnerships in recent British political history. So a lot of my successes, not all of them, but a lot of them, he is integrally involved in and you know, deserves the credit as much as I do. But he was a tough person to work for.
A tough person to work for. Yeah, I think some people would say something of an understatement there. That's Nicola Sturgeon, the former First Minister of Scotland, talking about Alex Salmond, who had also occupied that role. He has since died after he was acquitted of some very serious accusations against him. So there's quite a lot in that conversation, and you can hear it in yesterday's edition of Off Air. Nick on WhatsApp makes the very good point that we need to shout out to interpreters. I think we should shout out to interpreters generally, because I think that's an incredibly difficult job. I hope it pays well, says Nick, who is presumably thinking about the interpreters who'll be hard at work in Alaska tomorrow. I mean, what would you pay to be a fly on the wall at that initial meeting between Trump and Putin if it really is just four people in the room, the two interpreters and the two men? I mean, just phenomenal. You can contact the programme, yeah, you can, on WhatsApp 0333 003 2353, or you can email us, janeandfee@times.radio. It's 22 minutes past three. Val McDermott is the big guest this afternoon. She comes your way after 3:30. Now, the Trans-Pennine Express is the first train operator to use a therapy dog to cheer up passengers and staff. It's a six-year-old German Shepherd. It's owned and trained by a member of staff, but it has been certified as a therapy dog. He's never too far from the show. It's Ben Clatworthy, the Times transport and travel correspondent. Sorry, we seem to interrupt you on an almost daily basis, Ben. Ben, are you all right about that?
Yes, no, it's lovely to be here. Thank you, Jane.
Well, what else can you say, in all honesty? Anyway,
it's a terrible inconvenience.
Yes, okay, thank you. I think that's probably close to the truth. So tell me a little bit, first of all, about the Trans-Pennine Express, because we do know that rail travel in the north of the country isn't always the easiest, is it?
No, it's not. And Trans-Pennine Express was brought under public control a couple of years ago, back in May 2023, because of its poor performance. I forget who the transport secretary was at that particular moment, but it was brought back in. There were lots of strong words about the fact that it was performing badly and that it would be brought under the control of the Department for Transport and its train operator of last resort. Now, I understood that when that happened, that it meant that it would be run by civil servants, but people who worked there were effectively two-peed over and continued to... Sorry, it would be the staff that worked over there would be two-peed over and become public servants, but right. Also that the government would have a great oversight on it. So I'd love to know at what meeting they came up with this idea. Naya, a six-year-old German Shepherd who's owned and trained by the member of staff, as you said, certified as a therapy dog, and is now able to go and travel on the network of delayed trains to try and presumably cheer up these passengers that are paying over the odds for a shoddy service.
Right, OK, yes, it is. It's an interesting idea. I mean, fair play to them for trying something different. Do you pay extra to be on a service where you can guarantee a therapy dog?
I think the passengers of Trans-Pennine Express would say they already pay over the odds. It's the second worst performing network at the time of that nationalisation. I remember speaking to passengers who said, look, as long as it improves, as long as it gets better, we don't care who runs it. We just want our trains to come on time. Mm. That clearly isn't hasn't materialised. And yet now they're presumably being given therapy about that by the dog.
There is a serious side to this. I really do understand that therapy dogs can be incredibly helpful. Something lovely to pat, something just companionable to have around. I'm not quite sure why it would fit in necessarily on a train journey. And there are some people who frankly don't like dogs, or more than that, are scared of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always think owners that are very upfront in terms of telling people whether they can pet their dog or what the temperament of their dog is like is very good. On therapy dogs, my brother's got cerebral palsy. He can't walk, he can't talk. He's got a golden retriever who is not in any way a certified therapy dog and absolutely wouldn't pass any kind of assessment because she is possibly the worst behaved therapy dog you've ever imagined. You know, the dogs that can bring post and so on, she just eats it. But brings a huge amount of comfort to him and an incredible bond they have. And when he's, you know, she's intrinsically aware of the movement of his wheelchair and they do go everywhere together and she does travel with him, but he has to be very aware of the fact that not everybody likes dogs and that, you know, your dog bounding onto some people is not what they like. Just because you love the dog doesn't mean that everybody else does. So it is a balancing act, and there will be some people that think, why is a train company bringing a dog onto the railway?
Well, I think it might be, without being cynical, an opportunity for some good publicity for Trans-Pennine Express, which hasn't had an enormous amount of it. Tracy points out, I love animals, But I am wondering if it's fair on the dog. That's quite a good point. She also mentions that some people don't like dogs. And she says some people, like my daughter, are highly allergic to dog fur. Well, that's another thing, isn't it?
Yes, no, totally. But the thing is, you are allowed to take your dog on the railway. So it's not that you can't take your dog on the Eurostar, but you can take your dog on the normal network rail. And you can take your dog on the tube as well, because I always remember from the Paddington film where there's a very funny thing where Paddington's found himself a dog and then sees the sign at the escalator that says dogs must be carried. So then he runs off and gets himself a dog.
Yes, that's funny. Yes, that's good. Gosh, you're right. Absolutely. You know so much stuff, Ben, and not all of it is actually strictly
utter
speaking.
Nonsense.
No, some of it is in your brief, but not all of it, although, you know, Paddington was on a train. Actually, I do notice an increasing number of dogs on the underground in London, and some of them are absolute whoppers. And I'm fairly ambivalent when it comes to dogs, if I'm honest. But sometimes you do think, wow, that animal is quite smelly and taking up a huge amount of space.
I was on the Bakerloo line the other day in rush hour, and although London is very quiet at the moment, and a Great Dane got on, and you could see visibly people looking at it going, seriously, at this time of day? But it plonked itself down, and everyone, in that very British way, just looked at one another and made room and said nothing.
Of course they did. Yeah, that is Britain, even in the heat. Also, the fact that this dog is a German Shepherd, I wonder whether, I mean, maybe the staff have just had enough, and it's not right, of abuse from the customers, and perhaps having a German Shepherd to hand might not be a bad thing.
I did think that. Aren't German Shepherds, and I'm sure people on the text will correct me if I'm wrong, and they have lovely German Shepherds, but they are guard dogs, aren't they?
Well, normally I would have thought of them as that.
Yeah. Not. So maybe fare evasion, it can be a revenue control officer, whatever they're called these days as well, okay, once it finishes being a therapy dog.
Because you mentioned your brother's brilliant dog. I don't think we got their name, and they're clearly doing a brilliant job. I know they're badly behaved, but what's their name?
Sophie.
Sophie.
Yes.
And what was she again?
She's a golden retriever, and she was born in 2021, I think. Yes, 21 during the pandemic. So she's a few years old now. She's starting to calm down. We had golden retrievers growing up, and my brother has spent the last 3 or 4 years, however long it is, asking when she will be an adult dog, because even he finds her a little bit excitable at times.
Yeah, but as you say, it's the bond between them that's so crucial and clearly incredibly powerful. Thank you very much, Ben. That is Ben Clatworthy. Now, we had an email to the podcast not that long ago because we were talking about sport. In particular, we were talking about the joy that many women took in the Lionesses' triumph in Euro 2025, and that inspired a lot of women to email in, and some men, about their memories of school sports, particularly back in the 70s and 80s, when girls were very firmly discouraged from playing some brilliant games, including football. And rugby union cropped up in that conversation, and we had a great email from a listener in New Zealand who told us that she was coming over to commentate on the Women's Rugby World Cup, which starts in Sunderland next Friday. I think it's Friday. It's the 22nd anyway, which I think is a week tomorrow. So we're going to talk to that person who has now landed in the UK and cannot wait to start working at the Women's Rugby World Cup. We'll talk to her in a moment or two, and you can also hear from the crime writer Val McDermid. Good afternoon to you. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio. It is 3:30, and the latest news headlines come your way with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Officials say there was a powerful sense of unity during a meeting between Sir Keir Starmer and Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street this morning. Number 10 says they discussed Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Alaska tomorrow. The US president has threatened very severe consequences if Putin doesn't agree to stop the war. One of those consequences could be more sanctions. But journalist and foreign affairs expert John Kampfner has told Times Radio the current measures are making very little difference.
They have changed the name of McDonald's. Russians have to fly via Dubai or Turkey to get to their holiday homes in the south of France or to drop their children off at British private schools. But if you're in Moscow or St. Petersburg, far away from the front, if you're among the wealthy and the opinion formers, you are noticing almost nothing about the war and almost nothing about the sanctions.
The man accused of driving into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade is facing an additional 24 charges, including assault against two babies. More than 130 people were injured when Paul Doyle allegedly drove his Ford Galaxy into a crowd of supporters on May the 26th. And boys have outperformed girls at A-level for the first time in 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been opening their results with a record number getting a place at their first choice university. And you can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security on our World in 10 podcast.
This is Times Radio.
By river, ocean and expedition, you can now explore all seven continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Thanks for a lovely evening. Would you like to come in for a coffee?
Yeah, okay. That'd be lovely.
Oh, gosh, sorry. I didn't mean... I just wanted you to see my new Wix kitchen. It's just been installed.
At Wix, our experts will support you every step of the way, from a free kitchen design service through to a professional installation. Plus, with our spend and save offer, there's up to 50% off kitchen units. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Terms and minimum spend apply.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you? Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business-ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon to you. It's 3:33 and a half. Now, it's been a huge summer for women's sport, and it doesn't end. It hasn't ended with the Lionesses' triumph in Switzerland, because the Women's Rugby World Cup starts a week tomorrow in Sunderland. England are playing the USA. Now, Ricky Swanell is a sports commentator and a broadcaster from New Zealand, and she contacted the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast, which, if you don't know, and heaven knows I've only just reminded you, is our, it says here, hugely successful podcast available at 6 o'clock, wherever you get your podcasts from. I never like to be too boastful, so I think Fee and I have sort of settled on moderately successful, and we know we're happy with that, and we don't want to get any bigger, honestly. But anyway, it's relatively successful. Let's all agree with that. Can be very good fun, largely because of the brilliant emails we get from listeners. Like, in fact, Ricky. So come in, Ricky, because you're here now to commentate on the Rugby World Cup. How excited are you?
Hi, Jane. I am incredibly excited. Thanks so much for having me. I mean, what a career highlight. You get your email read out on Off Air with Jane and V.
Yeah, I know.
It's a great way to start the trip.
You still sound like you're bubbling over with enthusiasm. It's everything we could hope for. So tell us, you have loved rugby all your life, but were you allowed to play it or be a part of that world growing up?
Yeah, look, I mean, growing up in New Zealand, it is our national sport, and I was really lucky. Like, my whole family, we love sport. The women in our family love sport. Rugby for girls wasn't really a thing growing up. It was very much watching our national men's team. Yes, we had our national women's team, but you never saw them on TV or anything like that. I played a lot of sport. I played netball and I played volleyball, and I had people encourage that love, but and I knew that I wanted to be a sports journo. I wanted to be a reporter and talk about it, and people who encouraged that. But in terms of the playing side, I mean, I'm probably indulging my athletic prowess. I was never going to be good enough anyway.
Right. But it's turned out rather well for you in the end, hasn't it? Because you have been commentating on the sport for how long?
On rugby specifically, probably about 10 years or so, but I started in netball commentary. I've done tennis commentary. I worked in a variety of sports. I actually started out as a sports reporter on radio in the New Zealand equivalent of Talk Sport, effectively.
Right.
So I was a radio sports reader, reporter. I was a sports editor for a few years as well, and then sort of fell into the commentary side of things, and that's been me really for the last probably 10 years, and I'm now a freelance commentator, effectively. Gun for hire.
Right. Well, good for you, and I'm glad you've been hired for the Rugby
yes,
World Cup. Now, the Black Ferns are the New Zealand women's team, and they are they the current champions?
Yeah, they are the current champions. So this Women's World Cup is the 10th edition of the women's tournament, and New Zealand have won 6 out of those previous 9, including the last one 3 years ago, which was held in New Zealand, where they beat the Red Roses in the final in what I think was the greatest game of women's rugby ever played. It is a spectacular match if you ever go back to get a chance to look at it. And it was an upset. New Zealand had a horrible time going into that tournament. England were the favourites, and an extraordinary turn of events. So, yeah, New Zealand come into this one as the defending champions, but the Red Roses for England, very much the tournament favourites by a distance at the moment.
Well, I mean, I've been keeping an eye on their recent performances, yeah. and they have just been pulverising opponents, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, so the loss to New Zealand in the final in 2022, so just some context, that World Cup was actually delayed a year by COVID. It was meant to be in 2021. So that loss in the final was their first loss in 30 matches. They haven't lost a game since that final. I think it's up to something like 27 now for England. And France are the number 4 ranked team in the world, and they put 40 points on them last week in a warm-up match. So they are a phenomenal side. They've set incredible standards of professionalism, the way they play the game. It's a very different style to New Zealand, to the way Canada play, but they are an outstanding side with a couple of players who I'd imagine are going to become, if not already, household names over the next 6 weeks or so.
I know that ticket sales have been going well for this tournament, but Ricky, can you just describe the atmosphere at a women's rugby game? Is it something you could take your kids to very happily?
Absolutely. It is, and it's really interesting. So the last Women's World Cup held in Auckland, where I live in New Zealand, 45,000 at Eden Park, and that's the home of New Zealand rugby. They're looking at 80,000 at Twickenham. But what I heard from everybody at that last tournament back home is the vibe is so different, and I see it at women's games as well. There's a real friendly atmosphere. It's very much family. It's a really joyous kind of occasion. A lot of men's rugby, it gets a little bit serious, you'd be surprised to learn. The crowd can get a little bit boozy as well sometimes, pre and post match. And so it is, if you've got little ones, this tournament is absolutely a place you can take them along and enjoy the 80 minutes of rugby and everything else that's being done around it.
Yeah. And for people, and there will be people listening who think, oh, I can't believe the standard's up to much. I'm not even sure I want to see women playing rugby. What do you say?
Oh, please. Oh, please is what I say. It is a different style of game. The thing I love about women's rugby, and I work in the men's game as well, is there's a real a willingness to play and have a crack, as we would say, in the game and at home as well. It's not kicking. It's not a whole lot of scrum time all the time. There's just a real joy to the way they play it. And yeah, there's going to be mistakes, but that, you know, no bloke's ever played a bad game of rugby, apparently. That's what sometimes what you hear.
That's it's literally never happened, Ricky.
Of course not. Never played a bad game or boring game of sport, have they?
I'm not a rugby expert. And if I can be honest with you, what puts me off watching rugby is the stopping and the starting. And I don't always know why the whistle's been blown.
I mean, you and me both.
Okay.
There's a lot of grey in the rules of rugby, and that is an issue that the game has. And if you are coming along for the first time wondering what the heck is happening, you're not alone in that. And yeah, there is a lot of stoppages, but they're all elements. I always think the stoppages are elements to restart the game. So a scrum is a way to set a platform and get your backs going. Same with the line out or, you know, your big forwards. We've got such a diversity of players in terms of body shapes and heights and their different skill sets. And that's what the game, yes, with those stoppages, it allows all of those players to be part of it.
Ricky, just have a wonderful time. I hope, for England's sake, that you don't triumph again, because and it would be a brilliant thing for England and for women who play sport in this country to have both the champions of Europe in the football and the champions of the world in rugby. How cool would that be? The final is at Twickenham on September the 27th, and that is Ricky Swinnell, who's really looking forward to being a part of it all. Some breaking news this afternoon. Donald Trump has been talking to Fox News. He says there is a 25% chance of failure for his peace summit in Alaska with Putin. But he also says he thinks the Russian president wants to get a deal done, though he doesn't know if there'll be an immediate ceasefire. Right. So more with Callum McDonald between 4 o'clock and seven here on Times Radio. The crime writer Val McDermid is one of Britain's most successful authors, so really we don't have to have an excuse to interview her at all. But there has been a lot of speculation about the ITV dramatisation of her Karen Piri novels. Now, Karen, as you might know, is a redoubtable cold case detective who always gets there in the end, aided by her trusty sidekick, the Mint, the nickname because his surname is Murray, and armed with her omnipresent bum bag. So I asked Val, what's in that thing? Does she ever take it off? I also wondered if Val was herself bum bag positive, or was this just some TV affectation?
The bum bag is nowhere in the books. And in my head, Karen Piri is not a bum bag kind of lassie. She'd be the one with a neat backpack, you know, the neat little backpack. When I saw the scripts and the bum bag was a feature, I was like, she would never wear a bum bag. She's just not a bum bag girl. And then you look at the bum bag, I mean, it's tiny. You couldn't get anything in there. You could barely get your phone in there. So when it comes to the kind of kit you need as a police officer, it's not really what you want. I did have a vigorous discussion with the production team about it, but they weren't moving.
Really? I mean, this is a very good illustration of the power, or in some cases, lack of it, that writers have over their own material. Are you irked by this?
Not in a major kind of way. I mean, I have a clause in my contract that says they can't change anything substantive about the returning characters without my consent. And I think we all agreed, really, that the bum bag wasn't substantive in the sense that it made a profound difference to her character going forward. It's irksome, but it's a bit. You just take it in your stride, really. I mean, the basis is when you agree to an adaptation, you know it's going to be different. You know it's going to be changed. You know that things are going to be altered, and mostly you can sort them out between you before you get as far as the screen. But in this particular instance, they dug their heels in, and it wasn't a hill I was going to die on, you know.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad we've sort of settled that. People will be interested. Thank you for that, Val. And you're happy with everything else about Karen Piri, and people love the show, don't they, on the whole?
Yeah, I've not had a bad word said to me about it. I mean, I'm in a village at the moment in the East Newquay in Scotland. I've just been up to the fish shop, and Billy from the fish shop was saying how much he enjoyed it. He said, I just binged it. I watched it all straight through. It was great. And one of the things that people have been saying to me is how much they like the fact that they recognise the settings, that it's set, broadly speaking, where the books are set, and the fact that they've used Scottish actors where possible.
Yeah, and that surely they wouldn't give a major role in a Karen Piri or anything else by you to someone who is only pretending to be Scottish. Would that happen?
Well, it hasn't happened to me. But it does happen. You know, you sometimes find people doing the audiobooks of your books that have nothing approaching an accent that is in your head at all. And so that's sometimes problematic, I think. And I find this listening to other people's audiobooks, and sometimes it sounds really petty, but when they made the first Rebus with John Hannah, he comes from East Kilbride, which is on the other side of the country from Fife, and John Rebus is very much a Fifer. And we're all sitting there going, that's not a Fife accent. You know, in the same way that if you had a character in a crime novel, a protagonist in a crime novel who's meant to be from Birmingham, and they gave them a Norfolk accent, you'd get annoyed.
Yeah, so do you think there's a tendency to take liberties with Scots in a way that you wouldn't dream of doing if it was someone from the home counties?
I think it sometimes happens. I don't think it's necessarily any more the case in Scotland than anywhere else. You know, I think good actors can do the accents well. And, you know, I mean, some of the, particularly going back to the audiobooks, a lot of the audiobook actors are tremendous on differentiating between characters in the same scene. So it's about getting the right actor to play the right part, really. I think sometimes casting can be a wee bit lazy, but fortunately I've not been a victim of that.
Good. Well, that's good to know. And we should say there is a new Karen Piri coming for anyone who wants to read Karen Piri before they might well see it on ITV. This is Silent Bones and it's out in the autumn. Is there anything you can tell us about this?
The book opens with a torrential rainstorm. We've just had a storm here in Scotland this weekend, which was not so much rain, but horrendous winds. But there's this torrential rainstorm and part of the motorway collapses very near the Scottish Police headquarters at Gartcosh, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere in the country. It's central Scotland, but it always feels like it's miles from anywhere. Anyway, the side of the motorway collapses and human remains emerge from the murk. And that, of course, Karen, as the historic cases unit boss, is called. And that's where we start.
Okay,
it's quite interesting to me. I mean, because, you know, the way that the weather is going now, we had this storm at the weekend, which brought complete chaos to the travel of the country. All the ferries were cancelled to the islands. Many rail services were cancelled. There were landslips by railway lines. So I'm only waiting for them to find a body, really.
Yeah, well, by the way, you've got me. I mean, I'm now looking forward to, I don't know whether I'm going to listen to that or read it. Actually, do you care whether your listeners read or listen?
I don't, because we all consume work in our different ways. I have this conversation with people very often who say, oh, I couldn't read on a Kindle. I think it just depends on what's comfortable for you. There are times when I take my Kindle with me because I'm going away for a week's holiday and I'm not wanting to put 7 books in my bag. And so I don't care how people consume the books as long as they consume them. It's all one to me.
Well, you mentioned that the terrible weather has got you thinking about potential gory events. You have been quoted as saying that your partner says that she's had many a romantic break ruined by your obsession with murder. I mean, are you still at it, Val?
But still at the murder or still at the partner?
Or both. Answer both.
I don't think she's quite said ruined, but she possibly said, I don't know. She's never said ruined to me. She said disturbed.
Okay.
But the thing about being a writer is you're never off duty. It's not like a 9-to-5 job where you hang up your boots at the end of the shift and that's you. Ideas come when they come and you stumble over things unexpectedly. For example, we went on holiday to France one year, supposed to be a lovely romantic boat trip. And we had a little boat to ourselves and we were cruising through Burgundy and going down the Saône and it was just lovely. All these beautiful woodland around us, and small villages with lovely wee restaurants. But the thing in France is that unlike the UK, where you can only tie up overnight at registered marinas or recognised mooring points, in France you can tie up anywhere. And to facilitate this, they give you 5 sharpened metal stakes and a mallet. I mean, how can your mind not turn to murder?
So people with no knowledge of this equipment, for a start, they're given it and they're at liberty to use it, presumably. But as you say, it sounds potentially, you could do damage, real damage with that gear.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the only training we got on this boat was the guy showed us on the boat, said, show me the gear stick. He said, this is forwards, this is reverse, and this is the oven. And that was it.
Yeah, by the way, I'm not sure you'd pass as French, Val. I mean...
All right. I'm not a voice artist.
No, that's true. But you've got many other strings to your bow. Can we talk about how you are thinking or what you're thinking about Scotland and about Scotland's future? And you know, I've got to ask you about independence. And I know you have been... Well, you were someone who thought long and hard, but in the end gave your support to the SNP because... I think I'm right in saying that you looked at what the Scottish Parliament had achieved over a period of time, compared it to what had gone on at Westminster, and decided, okay, the Scottish Parliament's doing better. I want to back the SNP. I mean, is that broadly speaking what happened?
That was broadly speaking where I found myself in 2014. It was, you know, we talked about it, we discussed it, we discussed the pros and cons, and we came down on the side of independence, that independence seemed to be promising the kind of country that we wanted to be part of. We looked at other small countries across Europe that are comparable to Scotland in many respects and felt that they had done rather better in terms of social democracy and protecting the poor and the weak. than Westminster was doing. And so that was really what swung it for us. It wasn't some kind of blood nationalism or anything like that. It was simply that we felt that what was happening at Westminster and was just not what we wanted. We considered ourselves to be European. We wanted to continue to be part of Europe. And Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in Europe in the EU referendum. Mm. So that was what we were hoping for. And I still feel that that could be the case down the line. We have to, of course, now respect that we have to wait for Westminster to grant us a second referendum. They keep talking about this not being compulsory to be part of the union, but then they say, well, you can't leave.
Yeah,
so it's problematic.
I can see that viewed from your perspective, it might seem problematic. The SNP is losing some formidable women, isn't it? Nicola Sturgeon, notably, but also now Kate Forbes as well. Both will be leaving the Scottish Parliament after the next election, which is next year, isn't it? What do you think about that?
I'm not entirely surprised because there's a dark level of misogyny targeted against politicians in Scotland, women politicians. You know, Mary Black, who has left the Parliament in Westminster, has talked of this. And I've seen the kind of things that get said to Nicola on a regular basis. I mean, appalling slurs, sexual abuse, the kind of things that you wouldn't say to somebody you didn't like, never mind somebody you don't know. It's continuous, and I have to say that much of the Scottish media just piles onto this. The abuse that has been hurled at Nicola particularly since she left office, is appalling. And I know that that's addressed to other women in politics as well. I know a few women politicians, and they all say the same thing. They get the kind of abuse that is not targeted at male politicians. And it's not just in Scotland. I mean, this happens in Westminster too. If a young woman came to me and said, I'm thinking of going into politics, I'd say, think again, think long and hard about it, because you won't find a welcome there.
But if women don't go into politics, then we get a very different world, don't we? We get a world
absolutely
like it used to be, shaped by men. That's not good.
I never screw that simple.
Well, you can't. Yesterday, Val, people listening to the podcast or indeed to Times Radio will have heard an interview with Nicola Sturgeon about her memoir, Frankly, which is out now. And in that interview, she does talk about how over the last year, a couple of years, she has really found out who her friends are. Now, you are one of those people, aren't you?
I like to think so, yes. We've become very close.
But in what way have her friends rallied round and been able to support her through, I think what is, it's fair to say it's been, challenging doesn't quite cover it, does it? What have you been able to do for her?
Well, we've done what friends do, met up, had dinner, had a blether, drank a few bottles of wine, put the world to rights, and where possible, in practical terms, helped out. But mostly it's been the things that women do for their friends. I think women are very good at rallying around their pals when things get tough. It's been interesting that some people just fade away. People you thought were friends turn out really not to have been friends, turn out to be fair weather friends. But people who are genuine friends will be there for you.
Do you think that is what's happened to her? Have some people just thought, not sure I want to be around this anymore. I don't think I'll bother giving her a call or giving her a text.
I would say that's probably been the case, yes.
That is depressing, isn't it?
It's very depressing. But I think anybody who's in a prominent position has that experience of people who want to be your friend when everything's going well and you've got the possible patronage to bestow. And when that ceases to be the case, they just disappear into the woodwork and head for the next one.
Have you got any experience of that yourself?
I would say it's happened on occasion, yeah.
It's difficult to know Nicola Sturgeon's legacy, and this is something, by the way, that we did discuss in the interview. She was meant to leave Scottish politics because, she was a formidable figure, highly successful, respected, a great communicator, widely acknowledged as being one of the best political communicators. Is it going to be tough for her to move on in the way that she should have done, bearing in mind everything going on in the background, some of which we can't talk about for legal reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been very difficult for her to decide on the next chapter of her life. I mean, she's only in her mid-50s. She's got plenty of energy left. She's got plenty of mountains to climb. But the kind of things that you might have expected her to go on to were closed to her because of the actions of Police Scotland, because of what was going on in the background. Obviously, the kind of jobs that one might have expected to come her way have not come her way. But on the other hand, she has had the time to write her memoir and take her time with it and get to grips with the things she wanted to say. And I know that she wants to write more in the future. She's got her eye on writing fiction as well as non-fiction.
Well, is she going to move into your territory?
I don't know about that. It's a pretty crowded field, but if she wanted to, I think she could do it. Let's face it, she's got a front row seat on the workings of Police Scotland.
That is the thought, the final thought there of Val McDermott talking at the end about her friend Nicola Sturgeon. But it's just worth saying that the new Karen Piri book by Val is called Silent Bones and it's out in October. It is Times Radio. It is 3:30 to 4.
Global events.
The war has triggered an energy crisis, of course, all across Europe.
Reactive analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the MP behind that amendment.
Breaking news.
We're keeping an eye on the Middle East as ever, where Israel continues to face pressure from all sides.
There's this question about where the money will come from.
From the world's best journalists.
Time now to invite you to our briefing room and talk to one of our leading strategic experts.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jeff Norcott on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. Every Friday night from 7, Jeff Norcott takes you on an adventure through the latest global news, politics, philosophy, entertainment and the arts. Exploring the stories beyond the headlines and taking a light-hearted look at all the weekend's cultural highlights at home and abroad.
All that and more on Friday night with Norcott.
Every Friday night from 7 on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. What's not to love? Start your journey at visitdubai.com.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgette? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line, that's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
Fly direct to Texas and embark on a truly epic road trip adventure. Because there's no place on earth like the Lone Star State. Explore miles of music, food and culture from hill country to the Panhandle Plains. Experience cowboy grit, heritage, legendary hospitality, and those unbeatable cinematic sunsets in the great outdoors. Drive and discover your Texan road adventure at TexasFrontiers.com. Expand your frontiers.
This is Times Radio.
Well, thank you very much for your company today and indeed throughout the week. I'm back on Monday. Fee is back on Tuesday. You'll be relieved to hear. I'll certainly be relieved to see her. My guest on Monday will be the former White House Social Secretary under the Obamas. She's got a fascinating backstory, actually. She's called Disha Dyer. She's written a book all about it. It's called Undiplomatic. And you can hear from her at about 3:35 on Monday of next week. My thanks to Felix Forbes and our technical operator, Ryan Boyden, Kia Browning behind the scenes as well, and Eve and Rosie. And up next, it's Callum McDonald with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Jane. Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum McDonald sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: officials say there was a powerful sense of unity during a meeting between Sir Keir Starmer and President Zelensky of Ukraine in Downing Street this morning. And a man accused of driving into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade is facing an additional 24 charges, including assault against two babies. Coming up on the programme, what does the UK's former ambassador to Ukraine think the Trump and Putin summit can really achieve? And how much do we know about what will be on the table? And of course, it's A-level results day. Hopefully the stress is mostly over. But how excited can you be about the next chapter? We'll analyse it all.
This is Times Radio.
Now with the news, here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Callum. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says he thinks Vladimir Putin is going to do a deal on Ukraine. He also says the threat of more sanctions probably played a role in tomorrow's meeting in Alaska being set up. And he's told Fox News the talk should set up a second meeting to actually make a deal. He says he'll call Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders after the meeting, but only if it goes well. Foreign correspondent with the Wall Street Journal, Matthew Luxmore, says the two men are likely to meet one-to-one.
It seems from reporting that we've seen that the initial meeting will be Putin and Trump with translators. Then I think they'll bring in a bigger delegation, Witkoff, Rubio, etc., you know, Lavrov. And then I think they're due to give a press conference. But I think the initial stage will be the way Trump likes to do things, and certainly the way Putin wants it as well, which is the two of them speaking together.
The man accused of driving into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade is facing an additional 24 charges, including assault against two babies. More than 130 people were injured when Paul Doyle allegedly drove his Ford Galaxy into a crowd of supporters on May the 26th. Boys have outperformed girls at A-level for the first time in 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been opening their results, with a record number getting a place at their first-choice university. Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson has advice for those who are unsure what to do next.
If you've got what you've needed to move on to the next step in your journey, that's fantastic. But if you haven't, there's lots of support and advice that's available either from your school or college, but also through UCAS if you're considering going to university through clearing, and also the National Career Service.
Former world snooker champion Graham Dott is to stand trial next year over allegations of child sexual abuse. The 48-year-old is accused of two charges relating to a girl and boy of primary school age between 1993 and 1996 and 2006 and 2010 respectively. His lawyer told the High Court in Glasgow he denies the charges. And it's feared that great British puddings are dying out. Classics like rhubarb crumble, sticky toffee pudding and treacle sponge are on the verge of extinction, according to English Heritage. Fewer families bake and younger generations are turning to ice cream instead. Sandy Doherty, a former Great British Bake Off contestant, has told Times Radio that perhaps they just need to be smaller.
I think there's a way possibly of maybe incorporating them into chocolates, get those flavours into a box of chocolates to have with coffee or something like that. I think we do think that you've got to have this nailing down feeling from a British pudding that nails you to the floor in front of the television on a Sunday afternoon after you've eaten a double helping of rhubarb crumble and custard.
And remember, you can hear the Times' renowned foreign correspondents analysing the biggest global security stories every day on our World in 10 podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four. It's Thursday afternoon, the 14th of August. Thank you so much for being with us on Times Radio Drive. For the last time then, this is Callum McDonald, here while John Pienaar is on his holidays. Welcome to the programme. President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are preparing to meet tomorrow in Anchorage, Alaska, and the world is standing by to see what happens. Trump has warned of very severe consequences if Putin refuses to halt the war in Ukraine, and today has even offered encouragement that he thinks Putin will sign a deal. The Kremlin, meanwhile, has described the US approach as both energetic and sincere. They'll have a one-on-one meeting before delegations of five officials on each side continue the conversations. There will then be a press conference. But Alaska, once part of the Russian Empire, stands as a significant backdrop. Its history and geography underscore how deep-rooted tensions persist, even there. And today, it's home to 1,000 Ukrainian refugees, nervous at the thought of the destructive dictator of Russia touching down in what's really a matter of hours. Just a week ago at the White House, a historic peace accord was struck. Armenia and Azerbaijan signed a US-brokered deal to end the decades-long conflict in that region. And at the centre of that agreement is the so-called Trump Route for International Peace and Prosperity. It's a transit corridor. On today's programme, we'll hear from Azerbaijan's ambassador to the UK, who tells us that peace deal, mediated by Trump, definitely benefits Russia too. So today we ask, is President Trump emerging as an unexpected peacemaker? Or is this Alaska meeting nothing but a dangerous gamble? And uneasy peace may be traded for uneasy legitimacy. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Also on the programme this afternoon, why a gender-critical book has been removed from an exhibition at the National Library of Scotland, and why universities seem to have boosted their intake of domestic students after today's A-level results, which I hope have gone extremely well. You can text us, of course, on 87222. Start your message with the word Times. You can email studio at times.radio, or the WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353, and you're welcome to get in touch with your take on all that we are discussing. In the last couple of minutes, President Donald Trump has told Fox News Radio that he thinks Putin is going to make a deal, and says the threat of sanctions against Russia probably played a role in the meeting being organised in the first place. Earlier, Sir Keir Starmer hosted the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky at Number 10, where the Prime Minister warned his Russian counterpart must prove he is serious about ending the war. European leaders, including Starmer, had their online meetings with Trump yesterday, but how effective they've been in guiding this famously bullish US president towards a favourable position for Ukraine, of course, will not be clear until after the summit tomorrow. Let's begin our coverage this afternoon with Jim Townsend. He's the former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defence for European and NATO Policy. Jim, good to speak to you. Good afternoon.
It's great to see you. Great to be on.
Trump says in the last few minutes that he is pretty confident Putin is going to make a deal. What do you think he's building that confidence from?
Well, it could have been from some of the remarks coming out of the Kremlin by the spokesperson there. But he also likes hype. And he said good things a week ago. And then he began to walk those good things back, saying that, well, maybe we'll just kind of feel each other out. So he's kind of hitting all the various possibilities. And we'll just have to see what happens. But the great fear is that, there'll be a deal that Putin wants to make. He's going to strike a deal. And the deal's a terrible one. And that Trump feels pressure and feels he needs to grab that so he has something good to say at the press conference. Mm. So that's something I know that Europe and other world leaders are watching with some trepidation, that maybe he'll be too easy, Trump. Maybe he'll be too easy to agree to something coming from Putin.